Any questions?
Yeah. Well, going back to the idea of forming opinions and reacting to someone, say, judging someone based upon 10 minutes of interaction with them. But what if that interaction causes you to have a legitimate, fearful reaction to them? Uh-huh. They may cause you or your family harm, uh-huh. for example.
Uh-huh.
Isn't there value in that level of judgment? Uh-huh. I mean, if someone's threatening you with something verbally, that might cause you, to be in fear for your family.
Uh-huh.
I guess, where do you go from there?
Mm. Okay, so the question is, what happens when we meet somebody who is doing something that makes us fearful? Yeah, and is there any kind of valuable judgment or, that could come from there? I think we can look at it, if somebody's saying something menacing or threatening or whatever, you acknowledge that, okay, gotta have my wits around me, there could be some danger. But that person also wants to be happy and they want to be free of suffering. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, if you talk to that part of them, then the part of them that's menacing calms down. One time I was leading a retreat at one retreat center, and the guy who took me to the airport afterwards, he worked for the retreat center, but before he had worked for the police doing hostage intervention, whenever somebody was taking hostage. And so I said, well, tell me about it, because I like hearing about, different things that people do. And I said, how do you deal with that kind of situation? And he said, the key thing is to help to find something that you have in common with the person who has taken you hostage, or if you're the hostage negotiator in from outside, to help the person who's the hostage taker find something they have in common with the hostages. Because it is much more difficult to harm somebody that you feel something in common with. So he was saying, even if it's something of, oh, you like the Boston Red Sox too, something, what it is, notice something about them and form something that makes you the same. Yeah? And so similar, because clearly for the hostage taker, if they could see, oh, these other people are like me, then they calm down a bit. So in a similar way, if we, from our side, can see something in common, even with a menacing person, we might be able to actually help them calm down. Hmm? Whereas often, if we react to somebody fearfully, they feed on that fear. Now, I'm not saying that I can do this. I haven't had a lot of first-hand practice doing it, thank goodness. Of course, I might, in the next 5 minutes. One never knows what's going to happen in one's life. But, the main thing is, the more we can find that thing that we have in common, then the less we are afraid of the other person, the more we can build a bridge to them, the more they might calm down. Okay. Whereas, really, I think when people do make threats, they get a charge out of feeling powerful over people who are afraid of them. Mm-hmm. And this is what the inmates tell me. I was telling you last night that I do prison work. So they're all afraid to look weak. Yeah. Because to show their fear, that's what looking weak means, is to show their fear, because the other guys feed on the fear. And so they think that the opposite of doing that is, look at somebody like this, prove yourself. And I say, well, I'm not so sure that's necessarily the only way that you can hold your ground. Because, you know, to me, when I look at people who are like this, I see somebody who's frightened inside. Hmm? Whereas I watch, you know, sometimes I learn a lot by watching my teachers. Now, you don't always learn by hearing a Dharma talk. You learn by watching. And they can be incredibly firm. You know, it's like this. Gentle, but incredibly firm. And so I think that, you know, there's a way where you can be kind, but where you're not, you know, you're quite assertive and you're quite firm about what's going on. So it doesn't have to be a threatening stance in return in order to calm somebody else down or in order to let them know, you know, cool it in some way. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so how do you translate what I'm saying to a situation of domestic violence, especially women who are most often the victims of the domestic violence? Okay, you can have compassion, but compassion doesn't mean that you put yourself in a dangerous situation or stay in a dangerous situation. So compassion doesn't mean that, you know, your husband beat you last night and you go, oh dear, well, I have compassion for you, so it's okay, and if you want to beat me tonight, it's okay too. That's stupidity. You know, if you're in a relationship where you're getting abused, you leave. Yeah. I think the main problem that people have in those relationships is that they're quite attached to the person who's abusing them, and they feel a lack of their own inner strength and power to stand on their own two feet. And so because of a lack of self-esteem, they feel that they need the other person to navigate life, but the other person they need is also the person who's abusing them. So I think one of the big things in situations of domestic violence is people need to feel that they are an effective, capable human being who can act in situations and, you know, make wise decisions. That you don't need somebody else there to help you run your life. No. And so when somebody is not behaving in a suitable way, you leave the situation. There's no reason to stay in it. But you don't need to hate the person. Okay? So what we often do is we flip between love and hate. But actually what we call love is more attachment. You know, so we flip between clinging, I need you, I love you so much, meaning I'm attached to you so much, and I can't stand you, get away. Both of those are extreme reactions. Both of those are exaggerated. Neither of them is realistic. Because the person isn't completely wonderful, like you feel when you're in the needy, clingy mood, and the person also isn't completely awful, the way you feel when you look at what they've been doing. Okay, they're a suffering sentient being. Okay, so it's good you ask that question, because sometimes people think, you know, we have a very skewed idea of compassion in this country. We think that compassion often means becoming the doormat. Okay, I'm compassionate, I'm the doormat, walk all over me because I forgive you. Because I'm compassionate. That's not the meaning of compassion from a Buddhist viewpoint. You know, it's really not. When you think of a bodhisattva, okay? Bodhisattva is somebody who has the very firm, every time they see a sentient being, they have the reaction, is a very firm determination to attain full enlightenment in order to be able to benefit that other person, that other sentient being. Okay, so they have this bodhicitta attitude based on having great compassion. Now, if you're undertaking the project of leading all sentient beings to enlightenment, are you going to be wishy-washy and a doormat? You know, how are you going to help sentient beings if you're wishy-washy in a doormat? It doesn't work. Okay? You have to be kind. You have to be skillful. But sometimes, depending on the situation, you're boom, you know, like this. Okay? And again, I often look to my teachers as the living examples of this. You look at His Holiness the Dalai Lama, incredibly compassionate. You know, he tells the Tibetans, don't hate the communist Chinese, even though they've committed genocide in the country, and he's been in exile more than half of his life. Okay. On the other hand, he talks very firmly. Yeah. And he says, this is not acceptable behavior. And he's not afraid to point out when, you know, people make mistakes. Okay. So, but he does it. He points out the mistakes, but with a very compassionate, I mean, he's firm, but you know that it's coming from a very compassionate place. It's not coming from a place of judgment. Okay. Yeah.
I guess on the one hand, you, as a bodhisattva, you want to help everyone if you can. Mm-hmm. At the same time, on a practical level, in how feasible is it to help everyone? So the issue becomes where you draw the line. Mm-hmm. You can't help every beggar on the street. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're like in India, and that's, you know, right. India, you can just suddenly drop everything and mm-hmm. spend less, you know, just doing that. Or so what is the process in deciding you to stay?
Okay, so one question is, if you're bodhisattva, you want to help everybody, but kind of practically, that's a little bit difficult. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you gave the example, if you're in India, how do you go and give to every beggar? And the bodhisattva vows offer a lot of guidance in that kind of situation. Yeah, if somebody has nobody else to turn to, then you help them. If somebody else does have somebody else to turn to, and you're doing something else that's beneficial, you know, because sometimes it's choosing among various different things that are beneficial. So you have to see kind of what's more beneficial at any particular moment. But what's most important is, even if you aren't able to help on a physical level, that on a mental level you're wishing the person well. Yeah? Okay? So in the Tibetan practice we have this practice of taking and giving, imagining, where we take their suffering and give them happiness. So even if you can't help somebody, you still can treat them with respect. Okay? You can say, you know, no to a beggar in a very firm way, you know, looking them in the eye, not kind of rude and, you know, gruff and brushing them off like an animal. Okay? So there's different ways. I think respecting other living beings is quite important. Mm-hmm. Okay? So we practice these things and we mess up a lot. That's why it's called practicing the Dharma. It's not called getting it right the first time Dharma. It's called practicing the Dharma. Because we're really trying to do major level of hard disk reformation, you know. We're really trying to completely change the way we think. So it takes some time and it takes some energy and practice and doing it over and over again. And sometimes we goof and we blow it and, you know, then we have to go back and look at the situation and why did I behave in that way and why did I think that way and why I was really off base there. And if the situation happens again, how else could I look at it, you know, so that my emotions, my feelings about the situation are different. How else could I act? What else could I say? You know? And sometimes in many situations, to realize that there's no one perfect way to do it. Because it's another thing. We always think there's got to be the one perfect way of completely solving this problem easily. Who said that? That there's got to be one simple way of doing this. Okay? Things are incredibly complex. And sometimes, you know, in dealing with a situation, you try and do the best you can, but, you know, there's some harm that happens, but at least you're not deliberately trying to harm somebody. You're just trying to deal with the situation as best as you can. Okay? So I think sometimes when we hold that image that there's got to be the one perfect way, the one way that I could have said the perfect thing, and then that person would have totally changed. No. It's not like that, is it? Not like that. Life is pretty complicated. Yeah?
So on that note, in Buddhism, is there a vibrational tone? And is there the laws of attraction through that vibrational tone in being a Buddha?
What do you mean by vibrational tone?
you know, I think that we all vibrate on a certain tone, like almost like a radio station. You know, like there is a tone that's there that we all kind of in. And I think there, for me, I find that there is an attraction to that. Is that so in Buddhism? Is there a vibrational tone? Because if I see, there's a lot of conversation that goes on in your head. In that, in Buddhism, you know, like, is it so, or, you know, I mean, you're in that, always that thinking process.
Mm-hmm.
And in other possible ways of thinking, sometimes it's just a tone, a vibrational tone, it's just a sound.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sound, you attract others in that vibrational sound. So, I'm just curious, in Buddhism, is that so?
Okay.
Is that going to...
Well, is there a vibrational tone? I mean, so on one hand you're saying it's a sound, on one hand you're saying it's just like an energy.
Yes.
I've never heard my teachers talk about that. But, okay, I've heard some people who are not Buddhists, they will go to a talk given by His Holiness, and His Holiness will walk on the stage and people will tell me that they'll just start weeping. And He hasn't even said a word. Okay? If you look at that, I think there's something very strong about the power of compassion that can be communicated to people. I don't know if you use the words vibrational tone. I don't know if it's what you mean when you use those words. But I think sometimes somebody's presence can communicate what's going on in their heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And so you can get a feeling for what's going on with somebody. What we have to do, though, is sometimes within this, we're not... we think we're perceiving somebody else's vibrational tone, but all we're perceiving is the projection of our mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Yeah, because how many people, you know, like I was saying, we look at them and we form snap judgments based on how they look, and then we say, well, they're radiating that energy. You know, I mean, I can't tell you the number of times when I've done that, and then, you know, and then you talk to somebody and you find out they're quite a nice person. Or the person that looked nice, you talk to and you find... Well, I don't think I want to cultivate a friendship with that one, you know. But people often look different, you know, differently than the way they are. So sometimes discriminating what is, you know, our opinion factory. The Tibetans have this great expression. It's called namtok. And there's no real good English translation. But this is an excellent example of namtok. Okay, namtok means, okay, it means kind of preconceptions and judgments and projections and superstitions and, you know, wrong intuition. And just basically all this stuff that we put on everybody else, okay, that isn't correct. So, But sometimes there's a real discriminatory process that we need between, you know, somebody else's presence and what our energy is, you know, what we're projecting on them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you spoke about giving and receiving compassion to others. Mm-hmm. Is it called long practice? Tonglong practice?
Tonglong. Okay. Tonglong is the practice of imagining taking on others' suffering and giving them our happiness. Okay?
Would that not be a mind projection then? And similar to what Sue was mentioning about energy.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, this is an excellent practice to do in those situations. You know, if you're around somebody and you think they have very negative energy and you're not sure if it's their negative energy or your negative mind, one way to deal with the situation is to do this taking and giving meditation where you think that you're taking on their suffering, you know, and you use it to smash into your own self-centeredness. Yeah? So you take on whatever misery that they have. It destroys your self-centeredness, and then you give them your happiness. So it's a very good way to destroy our nam-tok.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that you're asking if you can really change people's situation by this practice. The Tonglen itself is just a mental practice. What we're doing just within our mind. Okay? That mental practice is going to, of course, affect how we treat people. Yeah? And how we communicate with people. So it can, you know, in terms of to the extent to which that practice affects our mind, then it changes how we interact with others, and it can change them. Yeah. Yes? Okay, so in looking at the Virginia Tech incident, how can we understand that? You're saying looking at it with compassion, but also understanding it beyond that.
Well, does it have would it be seen as having a purpose, or maybe something karmically has a...
Okay. So can we see it as having purpose, or as some kind of karmic manifestation? Okay. If I can assume that I'm talking to people who have an idea about karma, or who have some belief in karma and its effects, then I will give one answer. If I'm not talking to a group of people who have that belief, then I respond in a different way. Okay? Yeah. Because you have to be skillful when people are grieving, and you have to be skillful according to their own worldview and way of understanding things. But in a Buddhist sense, when we talk about karma, karma simply means our actions. Okay? What we think, what we say, what we do. Yeah? Our actions bring results. Some of the results happen immediately. Some of the results happen much, much later. Okay? So we do the action, there's a karmic imprint left on our mind, and then the result comes at a much later time when other causes and conditions have come together. It's kind of like it's spring now and we plant seeds in the garden. They don't grow immediately, you know. When it rains, when the sun heats them up, you know, when they get, you know, some fertilizer, then they start to grow. So it's the same thing with the karmic seeds on our mind. You know, different other conditions have to be intact for them to ripen. In the situation of Virginia Tech, the way I would look at it, I mean, it's a tragic situation for everybody involved, the victims and the perpetrator. And to me, it's, you look at this and it's such a manifestation of the horror of samsara. Samsara being this cycle of existence that we go through under the influence of ignorance and our previous karma. Okay. So just taking a body, you know, that gets old and sick and dies, and a mind that's full of the kind of rubbish that our mind is sometimes full of, you know, that is samsara, and we do it automatically by the force of the ignorance and karma. There's a whole teaching called the 12 links that describes how this occurs. So the way I would look at it, okay, if we look at the perpetrator, yeah, if we look at right now the kind of karma this man created, you know, is horrible. I mean, killing human beings deliberately is a very horrible form of karma. Okay? And so, you know, doing that puts incredibly horrible negative karmic seeds, you know, on his mind stream. And then dying the way he did in a state of complete suffering with so much violence in immediate proximity to his death, you know, kind of sets the karmic stage for a really horrible rebirth. Okay? Where he's actually, in fact, in much more pain than the pain he experienced as a human being. And the guy clearly was in a lot of pain, you know. He was mentally unsound. So there's a lot of karma created there and a horrible rebirth. We can look at that, and there's something in us that can understand that, that you do something horrible, you experience horrible results. Okay, looking from what he's doing to the future. And we can practice having compassion for him, for the pain he was experiencing and for the suffering that he's undergoing right now. Now, what I'm about to say is a little bit more difficult to understand. It's the same principle, but our mind finds it more difficult. Okay? The people who were killed, okay, why were those people killed? Why, you know, they had created the cause to be in that situation in proximity to somebody who was crazed. Okay? It was their previous karma that made them be in that proximity and to be killed or wounded. Okay? What makes this harder for us to understand is the person that they were when they got killed is acting and looking much different than the person that they were when they did whatever action in a previous life that created that karmic seed that brought this result. Because how they look this life, there's these young kids, you know? It's like, you know, up and coming next generation. And some of these very talented professors who were incredible people really doing excellent work, you know, serving their students. So when you look at it, just this life, it's like, why should these people get killed? You know, what have they done? It doesn't make any sense. But if you look at it over a big picture of many lifetimes, okay, sometime in the past, who knows who they were or what they did, but they may have, you know, harmed somebody else to the extent that they were harmed in this life. Okay? So we can see, too, having a bad rebirth, or even if he's born as a human being in the future, maybe being killed. Okay? We can look from the perpetrator and see suffering in the future, but when he gets killed as a human being in the future, he might be a very innocent-looking young person. But it's the same continuity of consciousness. So similarly, the young people who were killed and the old people who were killed in the Virginia Tech incident, sometime in a previous life had created some harmful karma so that their present lifespan is cut off short.
Mm.
Okay? So probably the karma of killing in some way. Now, this all happened as a group. Okay? So there's some group connection too. All these people were there together as a group, getting killed in some way as a group. Some connection. No? I'm just making hypotheses here. I'm not saying this is what they did. Okay?
Could I make a quick note just to help?
Mm-hmm.
I think that what you're saying, you know, is so that I think it's very difficult for Westerners to understand that kind of reasoning without going into, you know, all victimization and really all kinds of things. It has to really be understood in the context of really understanding not just karma but reincarnation.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
You have to have a deep understanding of reincarnation of my little footnote.
Yes.
Since, you know, if you don't have that, I don't think it's possible to understand that reasoning.
Right. Yeah. Right. When I speak about karma, to me, karma assumes an understanding of reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I didn't mention it. But you're quite right. It does definitely entail an understanding of reincarnation, which is why I said at the beginning, if I'm speaking to an audience that doesn't have a view of karma implying also of reincarnation, that I'm not going to give the answer that I'm giving, okay? Because I'm implying a certain worldview. Can you just hold on so that I can come try and figure out where I left off? Where was I?
Group.
The group karma. Yes. Okay. We can look at when there is a gang war. Okay? And many people getting killed in a gang war. There's some group karma there. And there's the group karma of the people who are killing together in a gang war. You know, people who are killing together. Or in a terrorist attack, the people who are perpetrating the terrorist attack are creating karma together. The people who are soldiers in an army are creating karma together. Yeah, we create karma in groups. This can also bring us experiencing the result in groups. Okay? So in this kind of situation where people are tragically getting killed together, they could have created the karma together. We look right now, we are sitting together as a group here at Menla. Yeah. We think it just happened all by accident. Yeah. It didn't. You know, why are we here? There are other people who wanted to come today who didn't. Okay. For one reason or another, they couldn't get themselves here. Why are we here? Okay? So, we have our own individual karma, but we're also experiencing the result of some collective karma that we're able to come together. At the same time, we're also creating collective karma, as well as individual karma, by being together. So, we came together. Yeah, not for the purpose of destroying the gang across the street, okay, or destroying the insurgents, okay. We didn't. The only enemy we want to destroy is our own self-centeredness and self-grasping ignorance. Okay, we came together, you know, with some common aspiration to learn something that will improve the quality of our life. Yeah. So by coming together, and then you noticed how last night we began everything by generating our motivation? Okay? So we generate a motivation for being together this weekend so that we make sure while we're together, as a group, we're creating good karma. Okay? So we create karma depending upon the groups that we join and whether we support the aims of those different groups. So it's very important to select well the groups rejoin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what is the purpose of this group that I am intentionally joining? Because joining a group assumes that we, go along with the purpose of the group. Now, some groups we find ourselves in automatically. We did not choose to be in them. Okay? I live in Washington State. Washington State has the death penalty that it enacts. I do not agree with that policy. Okay? But when they have an execution, I am very clear. I do not agree with this decision of the Washington State government and the majority of its citizens. And I want no part of the karma of what is being enacted at this point, you know. Okay? But then other times when we deliberately join, you know, a group, if you enroll in, you know, you don't enlist, that's the word, you enlist in the army, you know, you're going along with the purpose of that group. If you deliberately choose to come to a Dharma course, you're going along with the purpose for what that group came together. So we're creating group karma at the same time, together.
Mm-hmm.
Within this, we are also experiencing the result of our individual karma, and we're also creating more individual karma. Okay, so we're experiencing the result of our individual karma, because some people might be sitting here saying, oh, this is really interesting and it's helping me a lot. And somebody else might be sitting here going, falling asleep, you know, this is so boring. Okay, so they're experiencing, you know, maybe some previous result. And at the same time, they're creating, by what, you know, we're all thinking as an individual, we're creating also some of our own individual karma. Okay, so karma is an incredibly complex topic. Yeah? But to return to your initial question, I find reading the newspaper, watching the news, it's an incredible teaching on karma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, incredible. And what it does for me is, first of all, like in the Virginia Tech incident, if I were to use this as my own karmic meditation, it shows me, you know, do not harm anybody else physically. Okay? Because if I harm any other living being physically, I'm creating the cause to be killed myself. Okay? So whether I am the perpetrator here or the victims here who are experiencing the result of what they did before, the lesson for me is to not harm anybody physically. Yeah. Can I look back in my own life and say I've never harmed anybody physically? No, I cannot say that. I used to take snails when I was a little kid and pile them up and step on them. And think how good I was killing all the snails. And I used to swat flies. On my 21st birthday, I'm quite ashamed of this, my friends took me out for live lobster dinner, and we chose our lobsters, and, you know, they got cooked in the hot water by our own choice. You know, you celebrate your 21st birthday creating the cause for a lower rebirth. You know, I've come to, you know, to have much regret for what I've done at my birthday party, you know. And, it was a good lesson for me, you know, because in Buddhism, how you define friendship is different than in ordinary worldly ways how you define friendship. And I began to see, in looking at that, that some of the people who on a worldly way are my friends, who wish me well on a worldly way, because they don't understand rebirth and karma, actually encourage me to do negative things because they think I'm going to have happiness from doing it. But actually, it's creating the cause for suffering. So in a Buddhist sense, the people who are your actual friends aren't the people who necessarily say, yes, 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 do this, poor thing, we agree with you. Sometimes they're the people who say, what in the world are you doing? That is not the right decision. And who force you to wake up and go, oh, you're right, you know, I didn't have a good motivation and I wasn't acting ethically. You know, so your friends are not necessarily somebody who pats you on the back from a Buddhist sense. They can be the people who really wake you up. Yeah, because they care about you for the long term, not just for this life. Okay? So in looking at, you know, that situation, okay, what can I learn from it? You know, I look at that. I look and there were a couple of professors who, you know, one professor who pushed a bunch of students into his office and then went to check out what's going on, and another professor who was the one who forced the door closed and got killed. You know, both of these professors got killed. But they were thinking of others, you know. I mean, the other people were just like, it came out of the blue. They didn't even have a chance. But, you know, you look at these people and they die, but they died with some compassionate thought to protect the life of others. Yeah? So that's going to be a very different way of dying than dying, let's say, you know, as the perpetrator died. You know, where his mind was so in so much torment. Okay? So it's going to lead to different karma ripening.
Mm-hmm. So, are you saying is there any place for randomness in the story?
Is there any place for randomness? No. Yeah? Because things happen due to causes. And we may not know the cause. Okay? Karma is incredibly difficult to understand. So difficult that they say that in a situation like this, knowing specifically the karma, the actions of previous life actions of everybody else in that situation, is only something that the Buddha could know. Because it takes an omniscient mind to know that level of detail about karma. One thing I need to bring up also about a couple of other thoughts I've had about Mr. Is it pronounced Chu or Chu? Chu. Because I don't watch TV. I'm assuming it's Chu. Anyway, and in looking at his situation, one of the karmic results of killing is not only to be killed oneself, but to have the inclination to kill again. Just as one of the karmic results of generosity is to have the tendency to be generous again. Okay? We are creatures of habit. So it's quite possible that his previous karma, you know, maybe he had, you know, in some rebirth, some killing, and, you know, that karma is adding to his tendency to kill. I was also contemplating, because and these are just my thoughts, okay? Somebody who is mentally ill like that, yeah, is not in their right mind. Now, I know with our monastic vows, if you are mentally ill when you break a monastic vow, it is not considered a complete transgression because you were not in your right state of mind. And in Buddhism, it talks about spirit interference. I think it's kind of folk culture, and there is a base in Buddhism, but like the Tibetans, when people have what we call mental illness, they call it spirit interference. So somebody who's hearing voices, somebody who's seeing things, you know, sometimes in the case of very severe depression or something like that, the Tibetans call it spirit interference. Now, whether it really is spirit interference or not, I don't know. Okay. His Holiness lots of times tells the Tibetans, you call things spirit interference and they're not. Mm-hmm. You know. But I also wonder sometimes if you see situations, because we don't know his mental state. He could have been having some kind of hallucinations or hearing voices or something, you know? It could have been some kind of spirit interference that led to a very deranged state of mind. He could have been totally sane. He could have been completely insane. We don't know. Okay? But the karma he's creating, if he were insane at the time of doing it, is different than the karma created by somebody who's sane. Even the law recognizes that, you know? We have criminal insanity, and those people are not, you know, imprisoned in the same way that the people who do it in cold blood are. Okay, so the whole topic of karma, I'm just speaking in generalities here. You know, I'm not qualified to speak on the specific things of the situation. But I think in this term, there is something for us to learn from it. You know? Because also, in how do we react to this kind of thing? If we react with a lot of hatred, what energy are we putting in our mind? We are putting hatred in our mind. What energy made him kill those people? Hatred. Yeah? Do we want to hate him? Yeah? What is the result of hating him? Okay? Does hating him harm him? No. He's dead. He has his own karmically created suffering. Our hating him doesn't touch him at all. Our hating him, what does that do to us?
Creates the propensity to hate in the future.
Yeah, creates the propensity to hate in the future. Okay? Do we want that karma? Do we want to cultivate hatred in our own mind? No, because we're going to experience the results of our own hatred. And it's not going to be happy. Okay? And then we're just putting more hatred out in the universe and instigating other people's hatred and creating a society full of hatred. Yeah. Which was why I was so touched by the Hindus' way, their memorial service of lighting the candle also for him, because they're not putting hatred out in the universe. Yeah? And I think it's so important in this kind of situation. Mm-hmm.